Hello, and welcome to the Skeleton Factory Podcast.
Episode 63.
This is your host, Adam, coming to you from Austin, Texas. And today I'll be taking a look at two films, the first being 1995's The Addiction, directed by Abel Ferrara, and a 2016 documentary called Dead Hands Dig Deep, directed by Jai Love. But first, let's play some catch up. I recently went out to Dallas here in Texas and went to the Texas Frightmare Weekend. It is a weekend long horror movie convention. It is a very big deal. It's huge. It's massive. And it was a lot of fun. I got me a nice Airbnb out in Dallas and hit the convention hard. A really big thing for me, a big draw for me, was to meet director John Carpenter, as I am a huge fan of his. I love his films. I got to see him perform with his band live several years ago, and I wanted to meet the man in person, and I got to do that. It was very cool. I was kind of blown away by how many layers of security John Carpenter keeps around him. It's like meeting the president or something. He wasn't just sitting in the convention hall at a table. Like, he had a whole floor to himself. And anyways, it was quite the process to just be in a room in his presence. But I got to meet John Carpenter, and he signed a vintage poster I had for his film In the Mouth of Madness, a great, great film that if you have not seen it, I definitely recommend. It's very entertaining. But yes, I am currently waiting on my my frame so that I can frame it here in the studio. And yes, and what else? I met a few people. I couldn't meet everyone that I wanted to. I was a little under the weather when I got to Dallas, which sucks. But I couldn't not go. Yeah, I paid all this money to go, and I soldiered on anyways. I don't think I was contagious, but I did meet a bunch of old actors, and in the back of my mind, I was thinking, God, I really hope I don't kill John Carpenter by breathing on him. But I did get to meet actor Andrew Robinson, who you may recognize as he was the bad guy. He was the serial killer in the original Dirty Harry films. The first Dirty Harry. Big fan of him. He was also in the first Hellraiser film. If you've seen Hellraiser, then I'm sure you've seen Andrew Robinson's work. But he was a very nice old man. He signed my 8x10 of him. It was a nice reproduction of the it was like an 8x10 of him looks like it was from New World Pictures when the first Hellraiser came out, like sort of like a company production 8x10 of him, and he signed it to Adam. Andrew Robinson, Jesus wept, which was a quote that I believe he may have improvised in the original Hellraiser. So it was very cool to meet him. I also met special effects makeup artist extraordinaire, legend Tom Savini. You know, he worked on the original Dawn of the Dead. He worked on From Dusk Till Dawn. He worked on a lot of George Romero stuff, basically, and also was an actor in his own right. He was he seemed really over it. He was not thrilled. He didn't seem thrilled to meet anybody, but I was just happy to meet him, and I totally get it. You know, I collect a lot of Fangoria magazines, and I see old ads for conventions from back in the 80s and 90s and stuff. And this guy's been doing conventions for probably 40 plus years. So I can imagine if he wasn't all, you know, sunshine and rainbows when he met me. I was probably like the 500th person he met that day, but I knew it wasn't going to go well. When I was waiting in line, there was a guy ahead of me who he goes up there and he's like, "Oh, hi, Tom Savini, very nice to meet you." And Tom Savini is sitting there and he's signing the guy's stuff. And the guy's like, "Oh, I just want to let you know that his girlfriend or his wife was a student of yours at your makeup artist school in Pittsburgh." And Tom Savini didn't even lift his eyes and look at the guy. He was just like, "I've had so many students, I don't remember everybody." He just signs the guy's thing and just shoves it over to the guy, and the guy just kind of looked a little deflated, grabbed his stuff and just walked away. So by the time I got up there, I was like, "Oh God, here we go." But Tom Savini, Tom Savini, he signed my 8x10 of him, and you know, and with the cost of getting his autograph, you do get a selfie. He just throws that in there for free. And a lot of other of the booths at the convention, they don't do that. They will charge you extra for a photo. So I did get a nice selfie with Tom Savini, but he seemed so over it by the time I met him. But it was cool to meet him. It was very cool to meet him. I do not nothing bad to say about Tom Savini. But who else did I meet? Oh, very stoked to meet actor Ray Wise. Ray Wise, of course, was one of the bad guys in Clarence Boddicker's gang in the film RoboCop. He was also Laura Palmer's dad, Leland Palmer, in the television show Twin Peaks, as well as, you know, Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. And I'm a big fan of Ray Wise. He's a great actor, and he was exactly like I pictured he would be. He looked great. He looked like Ray Wise. He was in a suit. He was very personable. He was very charming. And he signed a Twin Peaks 8x10 photo I had of him. He signed to Adam, "Wash your hands, Ray Wise." And if you are familiar with Twin Peaks, you know about the "Laura has to wash her hands before dinner" scene. So I have that framed. I have that, my Andrew Robinson and my Tom Savini 8x10s framed and in the studio. Wonderful memories for sure. Very stoked to have all that. I did miss a couple of people. Lines were ridiculous. Some of the celebrities, you had to kind of get into like a lottery system just to get into the line to meet them. So that was kind of a shit show. I tried to meet David Howard Thornton, who is he's best known as playing Art the Clown in the Terrifier movies. I'm a big fan of Terrifier 1, and I did get a really nice Terrifier 1 poster from the Terrifier booth that was kind of separate from where he was, and director Damien Leone, I'm going to call him Damien Leone, he was also there. But I really wanted to meet David Howard Thornton. He did like half the convention just him, you know, and then he was going to do the other half in full Art the Clown makeup, costume, in character. And I was waiting in line for that, but then the sort of intercom system lady came on and said that, "Oh, if you want to meet John Carpenter, you have to come up to the third floor now, bring your tickets, bring all your shit to get signed, you have to go now." So I had to get online and then get into the very long, time-consuming John Carpenter line. But I didn't get to meet David Howard Thornton, but maybe next time. He does a lot of conventions. So I also wanted to meet Keith David, who, big fan of Keith David. Everyone knows Keith David. He was Childs in the original John Carpenter's The Thing. He was in Men at Work, a movie that I have a soft spot for from the 90s. It was Charlie Sheen and Emilio Estevez are both garbage men, and he's sort of their unhinged Vietnam vet boss who kind of is with them on their adventure in that film. And he's in a bunch of other stuff. Keith David's in everything. He's great. He's also done like voice acting work. But getting in line to see him was ridiculous. I couldn't get in to see him. I just couldn't make it happen. I also couldn't get into the line to see Felissa Rose, who she also goes to every convention. She's best known as the character of Angela from Sleepaway Camp, the original Sleepaway Camp. And I don't know. Her lines are really long because she like is really good with really kind of personalizing every interaction she has with people who are in line. Like, she's very upbeat. She's very loud and boisterous and like really seems super cool. But it in because of that, it makes getting through a line to see her takes forever. Because she's not just signing shit next. It's just, yeah, she really takes her time. So couldn't get in to see her. But again, I'll probably end up running into her at some other convention at some point. But what else? I did end up buying a whole bunch of shit. Like I said, I got a nice Terrifier poster, which I'm eventually going to get framed. Put that in the studio. I got a really nice Friday the 13th Part 5 poster from Germany. Really unique, awesome artwork. It was printed on like sort of like almost newspaper stock paper. Like, it wasn't a glossy poster paper. It was but really unique artwork. It was like, you can tell it was a really nice painting of like the sort of fake Jason Voorhees swinging a sickle, and then it has like people running across the blade of the sickle, and there's a splash of blood on it. Very, very cool. Very much looking forward to getting that framed and putting that in the studio. There was a lot of stuff like that. There was a lot of sort of foreign horror movie posters, like a lot of original stuff there. Really cool shit. I also got a poster for The Devil's Rejects, and it was through Lionsgate. I think it was, and the poster seems to be slightly different artwork than I'm familiar with. It looks like it was probably a, you know, coming next summer, The Devil's Rejects. Like, it's one of those types of posters, but it's vintage. Looks really cool. It's got Cherry Moon Zombie. It's got Sid Haig and Bill Moseley in character on the front. Very cool. And then, of course, I got my In the Mouth of Madness poster. Again, check out In the Mouth of Madness. It's awesome John Carpenter film. What else? Yeah, no, I started feeling a little ill sort of the day before we took off to Dallas. I don't know what it was. I started getting like a dry cough. And then by the time I got to Dallas, the cough was getting like heavier. And then I was still starting to get like chest congestion. And I started like spitting up mucus. And I just generally kind of felt shitty. But I just kind of muscled through it. And then it just got worse. So by the third day of the convention, I didn't even go. I just stayed in my Airbnb and just kind of suffered. And which sucked because I brought my wife with me. I brought my dog, and my friend, brother Jill, flew out from San Francisco to join us for the convention. So we still had fun. We still had a bunch of fun. We went out to dinner and, you know, went to some bars, and we had a good old time. But, man, I'm actually still kind of feeling the effects. I've been basically sick for over a week. I'm almost been sick like 2 weeks. I just I'm feeling a lot better, but it's I don't know. I didn't get tested for COVID or the flu or anything. I've just been muscling through day by day, going to the shop, cutting hair, taking lots of Mucinex and ibuprofen, and just trying to get through the day. So, what else? I mean, I picked up a whole bunch of stuff at the convention in terms of movies. You know, there was so much stuff there, but it was kind of random. A lot of the stuff I got, there were some really good like VHS vendors there selling really, really good condition VHSs and Betamaxes and DVDs and stuff. And then there was a lot of companies that were selling, movie distributors that were selling their stuff. And I got a copy of Burst City from Arrow Video. Hold on, let me grab my Burst City DVD real quick. Let's see, I went to the Arrow Video booth, and I got a copy of Burst City. Let me read the description on the back for you. It's nice. Burst City is an explosive Molotov cocktail of dystopian sci-fi, Mad Max-style biker wars against Yakuza gangsters and the police, and riotous performances from members of the real-life Japanese punk bands The Stalin, The Roosters, The Rockers, and INU, in a derelict industrial wasteland somewhere on the outskirts of Tokyo, two rival punk bands and their unruly mobs of fans gather for a battle of the band-style protest against the construction of a nuclear power plant, bringing them head-to-head with the Yakuza industrialists behind the development of their turf. This extraordinary celebration of Japan's punk music scene in the early 1980s thrust Sogo Ishii, now known by the name Gakuru Ishii, the underground filmmaking wunderkind behind such works as Half Human, Eisters Neubauten, 1986, Angel Dust from 1994, and Electric Dragon, 80,000 Volts from 2001, to the next level, and is regularly cited as an early landmark in Japanese punk rock cinema. That is some Arrow Video. It's got all kinds of nice extras in it and things like that. And, you know, it's got different artwork on the back. It comes with a nice booklet. The quality looks really good. Every time I've seen Burst City anywhere, like, rather if it's on, you know, some crappy copy on YouTube or whatever, it's always looks grainy and bad, and the sound is really muddled. But this looks great. This looks great. 116 minutes. Yeah, so I got that. Let's see what else. I got a VHS copy. I felt nostalgic. I felt like I was in a movie, like a video store. Like back in the day, I was walking through and I just saw a box for this movie, and I was like, I'm going to take a chance on it. And it wasn't terribly expensive, but it's in very good condition. It's a movie called The Demon Within, and it stars Christopher Walken and Ronnie Cox. Ronnie Cox, of course, was the bad guy. He's Mr. Corporate Evil Man in RoboCop. And Christopher Walken, who is actually going to come up later in the episode. But let's see. The Demon Within. Let's read the back. A rebellious and violence-prone U.S. soldier stationed in West Germany is admitted to a mental institution. He soon discovers that the hospital is actually a secret army laboratory experimenting with the brain control of humans. Like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, this film allows Christopher Walken from The Deer Hunter, Brainstorm, Dogs of War, and Biloxi Blues to give one of his best career performances. Oh, does it now? Because I've never heard of this movie until I saw this. So I haven't watched The Demon Within yet, but I will get around to it for sure. I also went by the Unearthed Films, Unearthed Classics. Unearthed Films does some really interesting stuff. They do kind of more kind of edgier cult films. Stuff like the American Guinea Pig movies, The Untold Story, stuff like that. I think they also even put out a, I don't know if they put out all of the original guinea pig films from Japan, but they did have a copy there of Guinea Pig 2, Flower of Flesh and Blood, which is probably the most popular of the original guinea pig series. But I met the gentleman there who is that I believe he's the head of Unearthed Films. I'm blanking on his name, which I apologize that I blank on his name, but he was very cool. And we chatted briefly. And I was like, what do you recommend, man? I need something kind of different and something weird. And he recommended to me a movie called Calamity of Snakes. Oh, boy. Calamity of Snakes. Now, we're entering, like, Cannibal Holocaust, Cannibal Ferox sort of territory right now, okay? And by that, I mean there are depictions of animal cruelty in this. So let me read the back of the this beautiful Blu-ray for Calamity of Snakes. A developer discovers a snake pit full of thousands of deadly serpents on the construction site of a new apartment building. To avoid any construction delays, the developer brutally exterminates the snakes. Believing the problem has been solved, he allows the new tenants to move into the building. However, not all of the snakes have been killed, and the many survivors and their kin are out to avenge their murdered brothers and sisters. Soon, all hell breaks loose, and the building's new tenants come under vicious attack by a squirming army of angry and vengeful serpents. Yes. Yes, this movie was really interesting. It's really weird. It's, I would say, probably, I don't really know, but I would say probably more than half of all the snakes that you see on camera, and there is a fucking nightmarish amount of snakes in this movie, are real, okay? I mean, hallways filled with snakes, okay? And the snakes, every time there's a scene where the snakes sort of like, they flood into a room and start attacking people, a lot of it is like, you could, like, people throwing handfuls of snakes at the actors, and the actors, like, screaming in terror, and yeah, and from what I understand, a lot of the snakes, weren't poisonous, and the ones that were poisonous, they would just scotch tape the mouths of, you know, the cobras, and the rattlesnakes, and whatever the hell else was there, they would just tape their mouths shut, and that would be enough to sort of, you know, that looked good enough on camera. You couldn't tell that the snakes weren't able to bite the actors. But I got a kick out of Calamity of Snakes. And it actually kind of ignited my interest in going back and looking at sort of the more sort of odd and extreme Asian horror films of that time period. So, yeah. That's what I got from Texas Frightmare Weekend. And it was a lot of fun. I would love to go to it again. There's some other conventions coming up in the future that I also would like to go visit. But let's see. Let's move on to the movies, shall we? The first film is going to be the 2016 documentary Dead Hands Dig Deep, directed by Jai Love. This documentary follows the story of Edwin Borsheim, lead singer of the band Kettle Cadaver. And this is Edwin Borsheim.
My name is Edwin Borsheim. Yeah, hi, how are you doing? Yes, I'm here to tell you, okay? I daydream every day about taking as many fucking lives as I fucking possibly can, okay? I dream about walking out into the intersection, opening fire into your fucking car, ending your fucking life right there on the sidewalk. I daydream watching your fucking fellow pedestrians getting ran over by your fucking bumper as I open fire through your fucking windshield.
Kettle Cadaver musically falls into the metal meets hardcore punk rock realm with layers of gothy death rock and industrial influences. Now, when I hear Kettle Cadaver, I can hear sort of, I can kind of hear their influences or, you know, things that sound similar. So think of a blend of bands like Ministry, Midnight, Skinny Puppy, and Carpathian Forest. You know, if you can kind of mash that all together in your brain, it's kind of what Kettle Cadaver sounds like. And but, you know, Kettle Cadaver didn't really have the mainstream, it wasn't so much they didn't have the mainstream appeal, but they didn't have the mainstream appeal of some of the other, those other bands, you know what I mean? They sort of remained kind of underground, and, you know, there's sort of the Rose Tattoo to AC/DC, you know, if I was going to compare them, you know, it's like, Rose Tattoo's cool, but they sound a lot like AC/DC, and AC/DC is a way bigger band, and they're probably the better band of those two. So, sorry, all those Rose Tattoo fans out there, but, you know, Rose Tattoo kind of just sounds like a ripoff of AC/DC. So, also, Edwin Borsheim was in another band called The Hexed. And The Hexed was actually pretty cool. I think I might actually like The Hexed in terms of sort of purity of genre. You know, they're a bit more upbeat, more of a rocking sound than Kettle Cadaver. So feel free to go check that out. Who's this movie for, Adam? Who is this documentary for? You know, I would say if you're a fan of documentaries like Hated, G.G. Allen and the Murder Junkies, the Todd Phillips documentary, or the Lucifer Valentine documentary, Black Metal Veins, I think you would enjoy Dead Hands Dig Deep. If you love movies like 8mm or the Roz Williams film Pig, then I think you would get a kick out of this. You know, if you've ever asked yourself, hey, are there any other crazy, violent drug addicts who sang in a punk and or metal band that might have committed suicide that I haven't heard of? Then you may get a kick out of Dead Hands Dig Deep and the story of Edward Borsheim and Kettle Cadaver. So, the movie itself is largely snippets of interviews with friends and family and band members and Edward Borsheim himself at his reclusive compound in Temecula, California. And it is there where he shows us what has been dubbed his hell room, where he has an extensive collection of crude medieval type weapons like swords and maces and spiked bats, as well as bondage gear and the like. The room is even equipped with a front door studded with nails, making it basically impossible to knock on. And in the room, Borsheim shows us a hand-carved wooden mannequin of his ex-wife, Eva O. And Eva O is probably best known for being a member of famous death rock band Christian Death, along with guitarist Rick Agnew, who's also featured in this documentary. And Borsheim also shows us his bed, which is a coffin, of course, and other locations in Temecula, including his childhood home and these like subterranean tunnels kind of beneath Temecula, where he tells of ultra violence and partying and, you know, things of that nature. We touch on his sort of broken home. We touch on him being one of six children and having a mentally ill mother, and sort of his background. You know, where did he come from? There's lots of footage of Kettle Cadaver concerts sprinkled all over this documentary, like footage of an extreme and disturbing nature. Just so you know, there's your warning. Performances of self-mutilation and other shocking imagery, such as Borsheim piercing his face and body and genitals with nails and fishing hooks and hypodermic needles and screws and bolts and chains. And Edward Borsheim's dedication to extreme stage theatrics is, I find it very impressive, especially at the time that the band was active, which was from the mid 90s to about 2011. So the 90s was a culmination of the previous like four decades of rock and roll, the sort of self-indulgence of the quote unquote millionaire rock star was finally petering out by the late 90s. Okay. So for the heavier musicians, the heavier bands that didn't endure through this time period, it was a time that bands were sort of rather kind of losing touch or going soft and selling out their core audience or self-destructing, just completely self-destructing and sort of burning out at the fringes. You know, in the case of Edwin Borsheim and Kettle Cadaver, they sort of cornered the market on being that extreme band, and then eventually just sort of fading out into obscurity. And it's no wonder why, you know, at that time, the amount of angsty media that maybe reflected a little too accurately was, a little too consumable. It was everywhere, and it was very easily consumable. You know, growing up with wave after wave of 24-hour news cycle was, you know, looking back on it now, it's sort of a reminder that for all the things that change, so much doesn't. You know, if you watched TV, read newspapers and magazines, or surfed the primitive World Wide Web back then, or had any interest in music, you were overwhelmed daily by things like Operation Desert Storm, Rodney King, the LA riots, the Bosnian genocide, the death of Gigi Allen, that was in the early 90s, the death of Screwdriver frontman Ian Stewart was a thing that happened in the 90s. Metallica cutting off their hair and releasing Load. Kurt Cobain committing quote-unquote suicide. That took place in the 90s. I remember being in middle school when Kurt Cobain killed himself. And there were kids calling each other that morning who were like, I'm not going to go to school. Are you going to go to school? Let's not go to school. We're so upset that Kurt Cobain killed himself. Let's stay home from school. What else was there? There was ECW. Okay. ECW had its first pay-per-view in the 90s and sort of ushered in the era of hardcore wrestling and backyard wrestling and all that sort of stuff. Edward Borsheim, also big hardcore wrestling enthusiast, and I imagine that greatly influenced a lot of his sort of stage persona as well. You know, not unlike a band like Anti-Scene or something. In the 90s, you know, you had the Jerry Springer Show, prime time peaks Jerry Springer Show in the 90s. You had, if you're a black metal fan, you know, that's when Varg Vikernes murdered Euronymous from Mayhem. That was in the 90s. You had the O.J. Simpson trial. I'm sure a lot of kids watched the O.J. Simpson trial with their parents. I know I did. You know, you had the murders of Tupac and Biggie. You had the rise of Marilyn Manson. You had the rise of the Gathering of the Juggalos, Oklahoma City bombing, the Waco siege, the siege at Ruby Ridge, Ted Kaczynski, Columbine, the nauseating advent of nu metal and reality TV taking hold as the new disposable entertainment. All this mashed into a toxic home life is how you get an Edwin Borsheim. Okay, that's how an Edwin Borsheim comes into being. It's just, you're just inundated with all this crap. And that's how people like Edwin Borsheim come into being. And I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing, because I find Edwin Borsheim and Kettle Cadaver very fascinating. I find them interesting. You know, I like a lot of the music, you know, and other, you know, kind of bands that came around at that time that were really different and unique and kind of seemed extreme, you know. Even the goofy shit like Gwar. Love that stuff. It's awesome. Even to this day, I love stuff like that. And I'm an unapologetic Gigi Allen fan, you know. I love a good freak show. That's what it boils down to. I love a good freak show. You know. Now, it's rumored that Edwin Borsheim confessed to the filmmakers at some points that he planned to kill the documentary film crew. His plan was to kill everybody but leave the director of photography, Hazel Alakas, leave her alive to take the video footage to the media. And he wanted to call this Kettle Cadaver 3. This would have been the third installment of the Kettle Cadaver films. They're mostly filled with sort of disturbing live footage, and the first two were called A Taste of Blood and Among the Dead. There's DVDs of those that exist out in the world, and I'm sure you can probably go on to like BitChute or websites like that and find those two DVDs somewhere. But he wanted to make a third one. It sounds like it would essentially be a snuff film, and that would be his great final performance, I guess. But it seems that Borsheim took a shine to the filmmakers and changed his mind. But he did tell them, he's like, hey, you know, I planned on murdering you guys, but I changed my mind because you guys are all right. So, and I think he would have done it. I think he would have. So I am sure the filmmakers really appreciate his honesty. So, what is Dead Hands Dig Deep? It's an examination of Edwin Borsheim's personal exile from the world, really. You know, it's sort of a guy at the end of his rope in a lot of ways. And at the time of shooting, Borsheim supposedly been alone in his isolated home for a whole year. Okay. So, you know, only to rear his head one more time for this retrospection of his life and a life of self-destruction and chaos. But, you know, he's Edwin Borsheim, he's sort of one of those, you know, I do see him as a musician, but he's almost more of like a performance artist, you know, like performance artist in the sense of like people like Tenzing Huixe and Peter Pawlinski, like people like that, especially Peter Pawlinski. that's a guy who like nailed his balls to Red Square in protest. So that, you know, people like that. But on June 20th of 2017, Edwin Borsheim took his own life. A Facebook post by the filmmakers of Dead Hands Dig Deep wrote the following: "With incredible sadness, we regret to inform you that Edwin Borsheim, subject of Dead Hands Dig Deep, has passed away. Edwin was a huge part of our world for over 4 years now. He changed the lives of all the crew who worked on the film, and through his eccentricities, helped us learn, live, and love. While making Dead Hands Dig Deep, we felt it was important to portray Edwin as authentically as possible. He was much more than a troubled human being. He was an artist in the truest form and was as genuine in life as he was in death. We offer our deepest sympathies to his family, friends, and anyone else affected by his untimely passing. He was an unforgettable character, and his legacy will live on forever. We thank him for letting us into his world to tell his story. We will miss you, Ed. Gone too soon, but never forgotten." And that is from the filmmakers of Dead Hands Dig Deep. And that concludes Dead Hands Dig Deep. And it's an interesting documentary. I do recommend it. It's not for everyone, but I think it's a pretty subjective, I think it's an objective, really, look at Edwin Borsheim. You know, I don't feel like it misrepresented him in any way. It showed who he was, the art that he put out into the world, and how it affected the people around him, and, you know, whether that be good or bad. So, yeah, you know, I do not think that Dead Hands Dig Deep is streaming anywhere, okay? But there are copies of this documentary out in the world that you can totally buy, okay? So it's not that difficult to get a hold of a copy of this, but I do recommend it if you're into, I don't know, fucked up metal band lore, then I think you'll be into this. If you ever saw that black metal documentary, Until the Light Takes Us, documentary about the Norwegian black metal scene in the 90s and all the crimes that spun out of that scene, and incredible music and art. If you like that documentary, you probably would get a kick out of this, and vice versa. So yeah, that was Dead Hands Dig Deep. And now we're going to move on to the year of 1995 with the film The Addiction, directed by the great Abel Ferrara. Abel Ferrara, you'll know as the director of movies like Driller Killer, Miss 45, Bad Lieutenant. So The Addiction, starring the amazing Lily Taylor, who in the 1990s was everywhere, regardless of budget of film, her output of work was amazing and really entertaining. The movies that she was in, it was films like Dogfight with River Phoenix, the Robert Altman film Shortcuts, even like really big budgeted stuff like Ransom, the Mel Gibson movie, and also as having a starring role in I Shot Andy Warhol, which also starred her boyfriend at the time, Michael Imperioli, who you'll know from Sopranos, who has a very small part in The Addiction, but he's in there, you know? And this era of Abel Ferrara's films in the 90s was so strong. It's like, through the 90s, he did the following films. He did King of New York. He did Bad Lieutenant, Body Snatchers, Dangerous Game, The Addiction, The Funeral, The Blackout, and The New Rose Hotel. You know, and a lot of these movies really are, they're really a showcase of actors like Harvey Keitel and Christopher Walken. You know, just really amazing stuff, really sort of amazing dramatic stuff. And it kind of plays around with sort of genres a little bit, but The Addiction was shot in black and white, and the copy that I watched for this episode is a beautiful Blu-ray by Arrow Video. I didn't get it at the convention. I got this completely separate from the convention. But so we follow Lily Taylor, who plays Kathleen Conklin, an NYU student pursuing a doctorate degree in philosophy. One night, while walking down the street, Kathleen gets pulled into a sort of below-street fire escape kind of nook deal between two buildings by a character called Casanova, who's this attractive woman in a black dress. And she corners Kathleen and bites her on the neck, and then she disappears into the night. Now, Kathleen goes to the hospital, and then she goes home, and she tries to go back to school, but is too ill to be at school, and she checks into a hospital again, but the doctor tells her that she's basically fine. But she knows something is wrong, something is off. She realizes she has no reflections in mirrors, and the hunger for human blood begins to wash over her. And so she got turned into a vampire, basically. So she begins, you know, satiating her bloodthirst. She begins by drawing blood from a sleeping homeless man. Okay, and shoots it up, you know, like it's drugs, and then she moves on to seducing her professor, played by Paul Calderon, who's a regular in Ferrara's films, and she basically brings him over to her place, shoots him up with heroin, and he passes out, and then she draws his blood and then shoots it up and steals his money from his wallet, which is very reminiscent from her character in I Shot Andy Warhol, where Lily Taylor's character is kind of a part-time prostitute who robs Johns while they sleep. Yes, very reminiscent. And Lily Taylor was in the film Four Rooms with Paul Calderon. They weren't in the same scene together, but they were both in that film. And I have to mention that I have to mention that Paul Calderon was in 3 episodes of Miami Vice. He was in a season 1 episode, Home Invaders, that was directed by Abel Ferrara. Great episode. And he was also in a season 2 episode called The Prodigal Son. And he was in a season 3 episode called Everyone's in Showbiz. Each time playing a completely different character, because that's just how Miami Vice rolled. They were just like, fucking, you know, they're like, no one's going to remember that you were in. No one's going to remember that they saw you a handful of episodes ago. There you go, Paul Calderon. Just play another character. It's fine. Ferrara also directed a second episode of Miami Vice called The Dutch Oven. So for fans of Miami Vice, it's an episode that's just about the character of Trudy. Okay, she's on the sort of the Vice squad with, you know, Don Johnson and Phil Michael Thomas and stuff. But she's one of the Vice cops that's always sort of going undercover as a prostitute. So it's a whole episode just about the Trudy character. It's really good. It's really good stuff. So Lily Taylor's character Kathleen, she eventually moves on to a more familiar method of biting people's necks and sucking their blood, you know, the sort of traditional vampire way of extracting blood from people. And we get some scenes where she attacks 2 of her fellow students at NYU, including the character of Jean, played by Edie Falco, and Fred Rose Starr from the rap group Onyx, if you remember Onyx, who's also on the soundtrack. Edie Falco, we have another Sopranos link there. Her and Michael Imperioli both went on to be in the Sopranos. So one night, Kathleen tries to roll up on yet another victim on an empty street. And the character that she tries to sneak up on is the character of Pena, played by Christopher Walken. When she realizes that Pena is also a vampire, she tries to strong arm him, and he doesn't budge because he's got like super vampire strength and everything. And Pena is like an old vampire. Okay, he's been in the vampire game quite some time, but he hasn't fed on blood for 40 years. He's been able to abstain from his need for blood. An interesting twist in vampire lore, I feel. Vampires typically must feed regularly, right? But this movie clearly is sort of an allegory for heroin addiction, hence the title, The Addiction. And Christopher Walken, Pena, takes Kathleen back to his apartment and sort of teaches her a valuable lesson about curbing the addiction, trying to explaining sort of that you need to try to blend into society. You need to be as human as you can, even though she's dead. Or I guess she's undead, and so is Christopher Walken. So basically everyone who's a vampire is technically dead. But Pena realizes that she's sort of like new to the game and wants her to learn and understand what it is like to have withdrawals. Sort of a vampire version of being dope sick, really. So he ends up sucking her blood a lot and from multiple points on her body. And sort of the lack of blood will simultaneously weaken her and make her thirst even more for blood. So she's almost like jonesing for heroin. Okay. So it's like she has like almost instant withdrawal. And he takes off into the night and leaves her to sort of dry out at his place, but she ends up stumbling out into the street and collapses on the sidewalk. And a good Samaritan is walking by and picks her up in an attempt to carry her to the nearest hospital. And she ends up waking up and biting the poor guy. And after this, Kathleen must have had some kind of revelation about life or addiction or the human condition or something, because we see her sort of feverishly finishing her studies and completing her doctoral thesis, and ends up graduating and with a degree in philosophy. And there's sort of a after party after the graduation ceremony with friends and fellow students and professors to celebrate her conferral of her degree. Many of the attendees at this little after party were previously bitten by Kathleen. So he bit Edie Falco. She bit the, so they're not dead. You know, all the people she attacked, they didn't just like die. They all got turned. So the Good Samaritan guy is there. Edie Falco's there. Her professor, who she shot up with heroin and bit him. The dude from Onyx is there. And a bunch of randos, a bunch of other just random people. So Kathleen gives a brief speech at the party, thanking everyone for coming. And then all of the vampires at the party all just vamp out and start attacking and feasting on all the mortals at the party. It's like the blood rave from Blade or the titty twister scene at From Dusk Till Dawn. You know, it's just a massacre. They just kill everyone in the room. They feast on everybody's blood. And then after this, Kathleen is shown completely covered in blood walking the streets, and passersby kind of stop her because she's a woman covered in blood walking down the streets in New York. And apparently you can OD on blood if you're a vampire in this world, okay, in this movie. And she ends up ODing on blood, as in the next scene she ends up in the hospital apparently horribly, horribly ill. So at one point, in an attempt to sort of suicide herself, Kathleen asks a nurse to open the blinds of her room so that she can sort of be consumed by sunlight and kill herself. After this, like, a Catholic priest arrives, and she asks the Catholic priest, she asks for forgiveness, and the priest performs the sort of anointing of the sick, you know, a sacrament in Catholicism where you confess your sins, you're forgiven, and your body is healed, you know, theoretically. And it's not a scene of last rites or viaticum, you know, because she's already dead. You know, you can't give last rites to somebody who's already dead. So it's more of a anointing of the sick thing, which is a thing. You know, if you're like horribly ill or something, or maybe you're having a baby or whatever, or you're going to have some sort of major surgery or something, and you're Catholic, you can have a Catholic priest come and sort of bless you, that you'll kind of come back to full health. So she basically gives herself over to God. And in the final scene, we see Kathleen in a graveyard, and she places a single tulip on her own grave and then walks away. And you can tell that some type of change has taken place. Okay, it's daytime. She's walking around in daytime. She's not wearing all black clothes anymore. And she's kind of walking away, and she looks kind of, you know, she doesn't look all creepy and gothic anymore. She has kind of a look of kind of peace and contemplation on her face. And then it's followed by this bit of narration here.
To face what we are in the end, we stand before the light, and our true nature is revealed. Self-revelation is annihilation of self.
So what this final scene is sort of, it represents sort of the death of her former vampiric life, her life of addiction. And now she has the rest of her life to go on with, sort of abstaining, I would suppose. I'm guessing, sort of like Christopher Walken's Peña character, where she, I don't think she's a vampire anymore. I mean, or she's still a vampire, but she lets that part of her life die. So, you know. And that's the end of The Addiction. And I definitely recommend this film. I like it very much. I am a big Abel Ferrara fan. I think he makes really good movies. And if you can, go get a copy of the Arrow Video Blu-ray of The Addiction. It's got some really nice extras. It's got commentary from Abel Ferrara. It's got some footage of him in the process of editing The Addiction. What else is there? There's a bunch of stuff in there. There's an interview with Lily Taylor that is conducted by Abel Ferrara. It's really, really good release by Arrow Video. So The Addiction, go check it out. If you like vampire movies, or you feel like you've kind of seen all the vampire movies and you haven't seen this one, go watch it. You know, vampire movies, I love, because you can go any direction with it. You can go comedic. You can go very serious. You can put it in the past. You can set it in the future. You can set it in present time. It can be a martial arts film. It could be a love story. You know, it's very malleable. So yeah, the Addiction. So it's got a bunch of the Catholic themes are laced all through many of Ferrara's films, particularly the films written by Ferrara's longtime collaborator, Nicholas St. John. The movie's ending for The Addiction may seem kind of confusing at first, but according to Ferrara in the Blu-ray commentary, it's a redemption story from a life of heroin addiction. And Ferrara himself had a 14-year heroin addiction that he was able to overcome, and he's very open about. So, and you know, drug use, especially heroin use, does come up in several of his films. But a weird fact: one of the producers of this film is currently the Secretary of State for the Biden administration. That's right. Anthony Blinken was a producer on this film. There were several, but he was one of them. And you may know Anthony Blinken. You may know him as the guy who lied under oath to Congress back in December of 2020 when he claimed he never emailed Hunter Biden ever. But evidence to the contrary was found in the infamous Hunter Biden laptop that the CIA has confirmed to have colluded with Blinken to tell the American people that the laptop was, quote unquote, Russian disinformation in order to get Biden into office, among other things. So, yeah, there's your weird fact. Also, Lily Taylor. Check out her tour de force performance as real-life feminist writer and paranoid schizophrenic Valerie Solanas in I Shot Andy Warhol, directed by Mary Harron, who went on to direct American Psycho. I recommend I Shot Andy Warhol. It's a fun little movie. I Shot Andy Warhol also stars Jared Harris, who he played Andy Warhol in I Shot Andy Warhol, who was himself in a black and white 90s art house film about vampires in New York called Nadja, featuring David Lynch and Peter Fonda. So everything's tied together. Everything circles back around in on itself. So, yeah. Well, that concludes this episode. If you can, go check out Dead Hands Dig Deep. If you can't find it, I completely understand. But more importantly, I recommend The Addiction and any of the other Abel Ferrara films. He's got a whole bunch of them, but The Addiction's a great little vampire story, and you know, it was made on the cheap, but it was made by a real craftsman who really knew how to milk every dollar out of his limited budget. So, all right. Well, I should probably plug all my stuff. If you would like to get a hold of me, if you'd like to recommend any movies, if you have any questions about anything you've heard on this episode or movies, or you need some movie recommendations, or just to say hi, you can go over to Instagram at skeleton_factory. You can also find me on Twitter at SFPodcastATX. And you can find more episodes and support the show at patreon.com/skeletonfactory. You can go there and support the show for just pennies a day. You can help me maintain this ragtag production I got going on over here. Okay, I greatly appreciate that. Okay, that's the end of the plugs. Well, I will check you all on the next one. This is the Skeleton Factory Podcast, rescuing your movie night one movie at a time. I am Adam. Bye-bye.